My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Jonathan Gabey hosts a great podcast called Marketing Distilled. He's the master distiller. Jonathan, tell us what these fine folks are going to get out of listening.
On Marketing Distilled, you'll hear from industry experts and me to learn about more marketing things and taking those complex things and distill them down into actionable strategies or tactics.
Amazing. Where can people subscribe?
You can find the show at marketingpodcast.net or search for Marketing Distilled wherever you get your podcast.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Radhika Dutt.
A radical product is one that creates a change in the world, where we look at product as a mechanism for creating that change. You know, what I've found is, you know, the way we think about product in the industry, like especially the Silicon Valley-centric view, you know, the whole goal is to build a successful product. The end goal itself is a successful product. Whereas, you know, when you think about it more radically, the goal of the product is to create the change that you want to see in the world.
Radhika Dutt is the author of Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter. An entrepreneur and product leader, she has participated in 4 acquisitions, 2 of which were companies that she founded. She has built products in industries including broadcasting, media, advertising, technology, government, consumer, robotics, and wine. Dutt advises organizations from high-tech startups to government agencies on building radical products that create a fundamental change instead of optimizing the status quo. She also teaches entrepreneurship and innovation at Northeastern University's Damore McKim School of Business. Dutt co-founded Radical Product Thinking as a movement of leaders creating vision-driven change and is a frequent speaker at business events and conferences around the world. She graduated from MIT with a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering and speaks 9 languages, currently learning her 10th. Radhika, welcome to On Brand.
Well, thank you for having me, Nick. I'm excited to be here.
I am excited to speak with you, you know, in my one language of English. You know, boy, 9 wasn't enough. So I have to ask, what's the 10th? Where do you go from there?
Well, I'm working on learning Mandarin.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Certainly incredibly useful. So the other thing that I love in your bio, I'm always fascinated when things are seemingly divergent because we have ad tech, you know, all of the media, broadcasting, and then wine. Different, but in my experience in the industry, also somewhat related in terms of consumption and usage.
Exactly. You know, I found that early in my career, I used to hear, well, you know, if you want to grow in your career, you really should be specializing in something, in some industry or a particular kind of a role. And, you know, all my titles that I'd ever had were so different. It ranged from, you know, heading up strategy to doing product, CEO, program management. It was all over the place. Just like, you know, every single job I'd ever had, I'd never held 2 consecutive jobs in the same industry. So you're right, there was so much diversity in my background, but there was one common thread through all of this, right? It was the fact that no matter what company I worked at or industry, I kept seeing the same set of patterns where good products were going bad. And it was that theme and continuously seeing what I started calling product diseases over and over, over a span of 20 years that led me to radical product thinking and writing this book.
So I love when that sounds like a Dateline special, when good products go bad. But, you know, that's a great a lead up as any to, I was going to ask, because you have this radical approach to all of this. And I should share that we had a great pre-show conversation, me wanting to make sure I didn't transpose your name and your book title as well. But, and you shared that that was actually a nickname of yours, which I think is a great story, radical. But what makes, for someone who is obviously an expert in things radical, what makes a radical product?
To me, a radical product is one that creates a change in the world, where we look at product as a mechanism for creating that change. You know, what I found is, you know, the way we think about product in the industry, like especially the Silicon Valley-centric view, you know, the whole goal is to build a successful product. The end goal itself is a successful product. Whereas, you know, when you think about it more radically, the goal of the product is to create the change that you want to see in the world. It really flips around the complete idea of, you know, why are you building what you're building? It's not just for the sake of the product just by itself. A product is never justified on its own. And that is the fundamentally radical thought here. And when we think about it this way, you know, a lot of what we have reabsorbed in terms of these Silicon Valley ideas that, you know, we should just be iterating, trying different things and see what sticks, right? Instead of that sort of an approach where you kind of accidentally end up where you end up, the idea with radical product thinking is you first think about what's the change you want to bring about, and then you build your product very systematically, thinking about what's your vision, and then how do you very systematically translate that into reality? And that's what challenges really all of what we've learned about product, and that's come out of as mantras from Silicon Valley.
That's a real good point when you contrast it with what seems like it has arisen as the startup MO, probably from Silicon Valley, of iterating, and like you said, just kind of accidentally getting there. But your approach seems to be one that is much more vision focused. It seems like there's probably a lot of pre-work and homework that's happening very early on before any of this. Is that where this starts?
Exactly. You know, what I've realized is that this whole idea that we can just keep trying different things to see what works, it's such a myth, because in reality, and this is based on my own experience in startups, but even in larger companies when you have funding, my experience is that you have literally 2 to 3 pivots at most before you run out of either money or momentum. You know, and I say that even when you have lots of money, you have only 2 to 3 pivots because, you know, there's a shortage of talent, right? When you keep pivoting, people go like, okay, this leadership team has no idea what they're doing. I'm moving on, right? And so this is why when we realize that we only have 2 to 3 pivots, then we have to say, okay, how can I use these like silver bullets and, you know, only pivot when I absolutely need to? And that requires some homework. We have to start with, you know, being very clear about what's the vision and then knowing, okay, well, how will I translate that into an actionable plan? And then, you know, all your iterations can be driven by this vision and strategy. What has happened with, you know, the growth of lean startup and methodologies like agile? What has happened is we have come to think that we can discover our vision along the way. Let's just try things, and based on what seems to be working, well, that's the way we should be going, right? And that's, you know, that's like taking a road trip and saying, oh, I just want to have the best road trip. Where are you going? Well, I'm going to head north, but I don't know what I'm doing, right? How do you even know if you're going to have, how do you know you're having a good road trip? You kind of have nothing in mind as to where to go. You could end up in Boston. You could end up in Toronto. That's what requires a vision, so that your iterations are driven by this sort of clarity.
That's a great metaphor. I'm a big fan of kind of that approach. I use a lot of map metaphors in my own work, but yours with the road trip. I mean, sure, if you don't have a job or any other responsibilities or anything else to do, maybe just driving around the country this way and that makes sense. But most of us are trying to get somewhere. So if you're driving for weeks and weeks on end and haven't really arrived somewhere, then it's a problem. You know, you make a great case on, it seems like it's almost the overuse of the pivot. Oh, well, we'll just kind of shake the Etch-a-Sketch here.
Exactly. But you know what is interesting is that this mantra of over-relying on iteration has spread to every function, right? It's not just about product. And I'll give you the example of marketing as well. You know, I remember heading up marketing at a startup, and, you know, every advisor I had ever spoken to, you know, their advice was, well, in marketing, you just have to try a lot of things fast and see what works, right? And what happened in the startup was the founder had this vision of being the next Visa of the world. And so, you know, we realized after some time that, hey, you know, this is just really hard to achieve, because to be this next Visa of the world, you have to acquire both consumers and merchants. So after some time, we pivoted and we became a loyalty solutions provider for merchants. So this way we only have to, you know, attract merchants. But after some time, we realized, you know what, that's just a really crowded market. So we're going to become a credit solutions provider for merchants. And, you know, at the time I was heading up marketing, and honestly, I just didn't even know what to write on our website anymore and what I was asking customers to sign up for, right? Whether you're doing marketing or whatever else is a job function, this whole idea of over-relying on iteration really gets in the way. And what I talk about in terms of being vision-driven requires answering five questions, which is the who, what, why, when, and how questions. And what I've realized is these are exactly the same questions that a marketer needs as well. You need that sort of a vision that clarifies your who, what, why, when, and how to do marketing right. I'll give an example. What I mean by the who, what, why, when, and how is, first, we have to say, you know, whose world are we trying to change? It can't be everyone. It's not all consumers, right? What does their world look like? Meaning, what exactly is their problem and what are they doing today to solve it? The third question to me is probably the most important, which is, why is the status quo unacceptable? Because honestly, if the status quo is not unacceptable, we really have no business starting anything, right? Then you can finally say, okay, well, what's the world that you will bring about? Meaning, when can you hang up the banner mission accomplished? And finally, now you can talk about what is your method or your approach or your technology or product that's going to bring about this world. That's the how question. And so, you know, as a product team, you need a vision that answers these details so that you can build that product and you know as a team what you're really going after. But the interesting thing is, as a marketer, those are exactly the same questions you need answered so that you know who you're targeting, how to position this product, what is their problem, you know, and how is your solution addressing it? What's the world you're going to claim to these people that you're going to bring about?
I love that you pulled marketers into that too, because you're absolutely right that we're equally over-reliant on some easy and not so great habits, you know, and yeah, I think the marketing, you know, startup folk are over-reliant on pivots. Marketers a little too often love saying the old, throw some stuff up at the wall and see what sticks. And I'm reminded of, I think it was Tom Peters who first kind of flipped it around and said, in, you know, as opposed to ready, aim, fire, the ready, fire, aim. Because I think you can do the throwing of stuff at the wall, but the kind of casual, let's see what happens, I think you have to do some aiming after that, that and bring things into focus to actually go somewhere.
Exactly. And you know, what happens today is there's this really epidemic of a disease that I call hypermetrosemia. And hypermetrosemia happens when we're so obsessed with metrics and watching numbers go, you know, up and to the right. And being data driven is all great, right? And now as a marketer, we just have so many tools available to us so that we can be data driven. But we often, you know, in the process of optimizing, et cetera, we kind of forget that what we might be optimizing for might be what I call a local maximum as opposed to the global maximum. You know, when we have done this ready, fire, aim, if we haven't aimed for a bigger picture, sometimes we end up optimizing on the details, whereas we could be going for something bigger when we have a clear vision for what is the change we're bringing to the world.
You know, this is the point in the show where I feel like it would be great if I could cut away to a message for a sponsor here to cure hypometrosemia. But in lieu of that, we will break for our typical sponsor message.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Jonathan Gabey hosts a great podcast called Marketing Distilled. He's the master distiller. Jonathan, tell us what these fine folks are going to get out of listening.
On Marketing Distilled, you'll hear from industry experts and me to learn about more marketing things and taking those complex things and distill them down into actionable strategies or tactics.
Amazing. Where can people subscribe?
You can find the show at marketingpodcast.net or search for Marketing Distilled wherever you get your podcast.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
Now, back to the show. So your book, Radical Product Thinking, is broken into three areas. You know, if there's a, I always ask for what the elevator pitch to your system is, but I want to make sure, because there's one step in there I want to know more about, because I'm fascinated by this idea of digital pollution.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. To me, you know, when we build products, or even when we're doing marketing, right? When we don't have a vision for the change that we want to see in the world, we often accidentally create what I call, you know, digital pollution, because it's the collateral damage to society through our products and through our companies. You know, the analogy I like to use is, just as the industrial boom led to environmental pollution, the carefree growth that we've seen in the tech industry over the last few decades has really led to the equivalent that I call digital pollution, right? And I think just as we've started to recognize the effects of environmental pollution, I mean, it wasn't until we started recognizing those and recognizing climate change that any company could say, you know, we're trying to be responsible. But we haven't even started to recognize digital pollution and how much it's fraying the fabric of society. Until now, I think the conversation on digital pollution has kind of been really superficial. First of all, I coined the term digital pollution, but like even, you know, in terms of how we think about it today, mostly we think about it from, you know, the angle of, well, it's the big tech companies that are really doing this digital pollution. We think about Google and Facebook and Amazon contributing to digital pollution because, you know, we see misinformation, et cetera, really affecting democracies. But when we really think about what digital pollution is, and I provide this framework in the book in part three about five types of digital pollution, what we realize is every single one of our companies is contributing to digital pollution to some degree. And we really have to be honest with ourselves to see, you know, is this what we want to continue to contribute to? Because it has a profound effect. And I'll talk about the five types in a moment, but the effect that I've seen of digital pollution, it's really struck me recently that when I talk to people in, let's say, Gen Z, right, these under 30 people, I've heard so many people say that they don't feel like it's right to bring a child into this world. Like they don't want to, I've heard many people say they don't want to have kids, that they would be willing to adopt or foster because they feel like the world isn't getting better. They don't see that sort of hope, right? Whereas I think when you and I grew up, for us, technology was always going to bring progress. It was going to make things better for humanity. And that is such a fundamentally profound shift that the new generation doesn't think so, right? And that sort of optimism isn't there. That's really the effect of digital pollution. And so, you know, I think about Greta Thunberg's words, you know, how dare you, to political leaders. And I think we need to ask the same question of how dare we to ourselves when we're building products. You know, if we're creating digital pollution, trying to deliberately be ignorant about it and not think about it, that's really dangerous for this next generation and the kind of legacy that we're leaving behind.
And there's a product contribution to that. I also think there's a marketing and media contribution as well. I think that especially with all these tools we have, that's usually when I'm speaking somewhere, that's my closing. If we do this better, we can contribute to that. I mean, I don't want to equate it to environmentalism per se, but I think we can make a better world in our own little way by just creating it sounds like the product end of it. I mean, I usually just start with the marketing and say, create less noise and more connection with people. But you bringing that all the way out to the product side of that helps to create something that, like you said, why, you know, answering those questions of why does this need to exist? You know, what's it going to change in the world? And yeah, if the answers, that's why I you know, kind of made a knowing noise when you said, if the answer to those is it's not gonna, then you've got a problem that a pivot can't fix.
Exactly. You know, and you brought up digital pollution that marketing might be contributing to. It's one of the types of digital pollution that I call, you know, attention hijacking, which is that every single product, website, even news, right? Everything is trying to seek that one scarce resource, which is your attention. And what that affects in terms of society is that it reduces everything to sound bites because we no longer have the bandwidth to absorb nuance, and all we have the bandwidth for is sound bites. And why is that important, right, for society? Because, you know, I lived in South Africa during the end of apartheid. So this was 1991 when apartheid was abolished. And I was there during the first democratic elections, right? And the whole world at the time was waiting with bated breath to see if South Africa was going to plunge into civil war because, you know, there were all these factions who were talking violence, right? But there was nuance in the vision that Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk at the time communicated. And it was this vision of a rainbow nation. Instead of vengeance, they called for a truth and reconciliation commission. And this was such a nuanced vision that people got behind. And I think about how, you know, in today's day and age, with Twitter and Facebook, with Google, would we be able to make that same transition to democracy? I really don't think so, you know? And the last time when we said, you know, I don't do nuance was President Bush, you know, talking about the going into Iraq, right? That's the difference. Like, we need nuance in society, and attention hijacking takes away from that. So as a marketer, is just what you were saying, reducing that noise. I almost think of this as, when we create that noise, we're creating what I call vision debt. Like, it's bad for the world. So in what way are you going to contribute positively to the world? And that has to be part of your product. Like, you know, if you're marketing something, if it is bringing a positive change, if we haven't thought about what is that change that is actually and honestly positive. We can't say, you know, if you're working at Facebook, for example, you know, just connecting people isn't a positive change, right? Like, we have to be honest about what is the change we're bringing, really. And then if we're marketing that, like, there's more balance that we bring.
You know, and I'm glad you brought up Facebook, because the other thing you said in there related to we don't do nuance is, you know, we're quick to point to big tech, and not to say that there's not some problematic stuff, but I think it's that nuance angle that we don't do. We can isolate it all. Oh, that's over there. That's over there. I'm not a contributor to digital pollution, in the same way that we say, okay, it's a big traditional smokestack manufacturer that is contributing to the environment. So it doesn't matter what I do, and I don't need to recycle my yogurt containers and milk jugs.
But, you know, and that's such an interesting point, because, yes, one of the types of digital pollution that I just talked about was attention hijacking. But another part that we definitely contribute to, right, is the erosion of privacy. Every time we are using cookies unnecessarily, every time we're collecting data we're eroding privacy, it really is a form of digital pollution, because for democracy to exist, we need privacy and that separation of public and private lives. And so it's so important for us as marketers to think about all these different ways in which we might be creating digital pollution, because it's not just Facebook that's eroding privacy, right? It's every time we're collecting those cookies, and exactly like you said, every one of us is contributing to it through these different forms.
Well, this is a great conversation. And before we segue to the brand that's made you smile, you talked about leading marketing at startups. And I know we've got some listeners out there that may be doing just that. Is there one, you know, that's such a very specific challenge. Is there something you'd say to those folks about startup marketing that remember XYZ?
You know, the one thing I'll say is, as marketers, you know, we usually think that the vision belongs with the CEO or perhaps the product team. But I think we as marketers can push for a vision just as well, right? In a startup, we need that sort of alignment of vision across the entire organization. And it's not just true for a startup, but in any organization, right? So when I talk about this vision and the who, what, why, when, and how questions, even when you're in the marketing team, we have to ask those same questions. And if you don't feel like there's clarity across the organization, it's helpful to do what I call this, you know, visioning exercise, right? Where you do this as a group. And I'll give you an example of the radical vision statement. Until now, you know, every vision we've ever heard is, you know, it has to be this broad statement, something like, you know, empowering humans to express themselves or something like that, right? Like, that I find to be a fluffy and BS kind of a vision. A real vision to me has to sound this detailed. And I'll give you this example. It's a fill-in-the-blank statement that I have in the Radical Product Thinking book. The vision statement would read like this for a startup that I had. Today, when amateur wine drinkers want to find wines that they're likely to like, they have to find attractive looking wine bottles. or pick wines that are on sale. This is unacceptable because it leads to so many disappointments, and it's hard to learn about wine this way. We are bringing about the world we envision is one where it's easy to find wines you like just as much as it's as you can find movies you like on Netflix. We're bringing about this world through a recommendations algorithm that matches wines to your taste and an operational setup that delivers these wines to your door. Now, that's a radical vision because, you know, I told you nothing about my startup except that it was related to wine. But hopefully after that vision, you knew exactly what we were doing and why we were doing it, right? Now, that vision is kind of like the source code that your whole team needs. The marketing team needs this kind of a source code so that you can then create, you know, a clean build out of it, meaning, you know, you can make this sound pithy and you know exactly how to position the product, etc. But that's the kind of detail that you need as a marketer. And so don't be afraid to push the team to get this level of clarity on the who, what, why, when, and how. And the fill-in-the-blank statement that I just mentioned from Radical Product Thinking, you can get that in the book or you can download it from the website, from the toolkit. But get that sort of clarity. You can push the team to do a group exercise so that you then know how to position your product and kind of what will drive your iterations and trying what's going to work.
I love it. I love the idea of your brand's source code. That makes me smile. And that is as good a reminder as any that it is time for me to ask you for a brand that has made you smile recently.
So it's a brand that actually most people will not have heard of, but it's called Lidjet. What they're known for is they make papadums. So if you've had papadums, which are the lentil crackers you typically eat in Indian restaurants with chutney, well, this brand owns, you know, 60% of the market, and the rest of the market is, you know, fragmented between a ton of other players. But this brand is amazing to me because it's owned by 45,000 women who are all equal partners in this organization, which in itself, by the way, is fascinating to me. And why it's fascinating as a brand to me is that they're incredibly vision-driven. There is a whole story I tell about how this organization came about and how they're so vision-driven. They were formed by seven women who didn't have education. They wanted to create a dignified living for themselves. And these seven women started out rolling these papadums. And over time, they became 300. Now there are 45,000. But their vision hasn't changed in terms of bringing financial independence to women. And, you know, as they've grown, they've managed to keep that vision. And it's and their entire product is that mechanism to bring about the change that they've wanted to bring to the world.
What a neat story. That is fascinating, and I had not heard that, and I'm sure there are others too, so we will link up to all of that story, that vision, in our show notes. Radhika, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, there's the radicalproduct.com website where you can get the free toolkit, and you can learn more about the whole philosophy in the blog as well. You can message me on LinkedIn because I always love to hear stories from people who, you know, are using this approach to create change in the world. And lastly, you can also get the book, Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter. It's in bookstores around you.
I've got it right here, and it is a great book. Let's not contribute to that digital pollution. Let's do something better. Radhika, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you for having me. I had so much fun talking to you.
And if you like what you're hearing, if we've made you smile, remember you can listen free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your favorite platform may be. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Jonathan Gabey hosts a great podcast called Marketing Distilled. He's the master distiller. Jonathan, tell us what these fine folks are going to get out of listening.
On Marketing Distilled, you'll hear from industry experts and me to learn about more marketing things and taking those complex things and distill them down into actionable strategies or tactics.
Amazing. Where can people subscribe?
You can find the show at marketingpodcast.net or search for Marketing Distilled wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard him. Go subscribe.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.